couldn't agree with you more, sir," he assented briskly in a tone of ostentatious disapproval. "I just don't know what's happening to the clergy these days."
"They're getting better. That's what's happening to them," General Dreidel growled emphatically.
Colonel Cathcart gulped awkwardly and made a nimble recovery.
"Yes, sir, they are getting better. That's exactly what I had in mind, sir."
"This is just the place for a chaplain to be, mingling with the men while they're out drinking and gambling so he can get to understand them and win their confidence. How the hell else is he ever going to get them to believe in God?"
"That's exactly what I had in mind, sir, when I ordered him to come here," Colonel Cathcart said carefully, and threw his arm familiarly around the chaplain's shoulders as he walked him off into a corner to order him in a cold undertone to start reporting for duty at the officers' club every evening to mingle with the men while they were drinking and gambling so that he could get to understand them and win their confidence.
The chaplain agreed and did report for duty to the officers' club every night to mingle with the men who wanted to avoid him, until the evening the vicious fistfight broke out at the ping-pong table, and Chief White Half-Oat whirled without provocation and punched Colonel Moodus squarely in the nose, knocking Colonel Moodus down on the seat of his pants and making General Dreidel roar with lusty, unexpected laughter until he spied the chaplain standing close by, gawking at him grotesquely in tortured wonder. General Dreidel froze at the sight of him. He glowered at the chaplain with swollen fury for a moment, his good humor gone, and turned back toward the bar disgruntledly, rolling from side to side like a sailor on his short, bandy legs. Colonel Cathcart cantered fearfully along behind, glancing anxiously about in vain for some sign of help from Colonel Korn.
"That's a fine thing," General Dreidel growled at the bar, gripping his empty shot glass in his burly hand. "That's really a fine thing. When a man of God begins hanging around a place like this with a bunch of dirty drunks and gamblers."
Colonel Cathcart sighed with relief.
"Yes, sir," he exclaimed proudly. "It certainly is a fine thing."
"Then why the hell don't you do something about it?"
"Sir?"
Colonel Cathcart inquired, blinking.
"Do you think it does you credit to have your chaplain hanging around here every night? He's in here every goddamn time I come."
"You're right, sir, absolutely right," Colonel Cathcart responded. "It does me no credit at all, and I am going to do something about it this very minute."
"Aren't you the one who ordered him to come here?"
"No, sir, that was Colonel Korn. I intend to punish him severely, too."
"If he wasn't a chaplain," General Dreidel muttered, "I'd have him taken outside and shot."
He's not a chaplain, sir," Colonel Cathcart advised helpfully.
"Isn't he? Then why the hell does he wear that cross on his collar if he's not a chaplain?"
"He doesn't wear a cross on his collar, sir. He wears a silver leaf. He's a lieutenant colonel."
"You got a chaplain who's a lieutenant colonel?" inquired General Dreidel with amazement.
"Oh, no, sir. My chaplain is only a captain."
"Then why the hell did he wear a silver leaf on his collar if he's only a captain?"
"He doesn't wear a silver leaf on his collar, sir. He wears a cross."
"Go away from me now, you son of a bitch," said General Dreidel. "I'll have you taken outside and shot."
"Yes, sir."
Colonel Cathcart went away from General Dreidel with a gulp and kicked the chaplain out of the officers' club. And it was exactly the way it was almost 2 months later, after the chaplain had tried to persuade Colonel Cathcart to rescind his order increasing the number of missions to 60, and had failed abysmally in that endeavor, too. And the chaplain was ready now to capitulate to despair entirely, but was restrained by the memory of his wife, whom he loved and missed so pathetically with such sensual and exalted ardor, and by the lifelong trust he had placed in the wisdom and justice of an immortal, omnipotent, omniscient, humane, universal, anthropomorphic, English-speaking, Anglo-Saxon, pro-American God, which had begun to waver. So many things were testing his faith. There was the Bible, of course, but the Bible was a book. And so were Bleak House, Treasure Island, Ethan Frome, and the Last of the Mohicans. did it indeed seem probable, as he had once overheard Dunbar ask, that the answers to the riddles of creation would be supplied by people too ignorant to understand the mechanics of rainfall? Had Almighty God, in all his infinite wisdom, really been afraid that men 6,000 years ago would succeed in building a tower to heaven? Where the devil was heaven? Was it up? Down? There was no up or down in a finite but expanding universe in which even the vast, burning, dazzling, majestic sun was in a state of progressive decay that would eventually destroy the earth, too. There were no miracles. Prayers went unanswered, and misfortune tramped with equal brutality on the virtuous and the corrupt. And the chaplain, who had conscience and character, would have yielded to reason and relinquished his belief in the God of his fathers, would truly have resigned both his calling and his commission and taken his chances as a private in the infantry or field artillery, or even perhaps as a corporal in the paratroopers, had it not been for such successive mystic phenomena as the naked man in the tree at that poor sergeant's funeral weeks before, and the cryptic, haunting, encouraging promise of the prophet Flume in the forest only that afternoon. "Tell them I'll be back when winter comes." 26. Arfi. In a way, it was all Yossarian's fault, for if he had not moved the bomb line during the big siege of Bologna, Major de Coverley might still be around to save him. And if he had not stocked the enlisted men's apartment with girls who had no other place to live, Nately might never have fallen in love with his whore, as she sat naked from the waist down in the room full of grumpy blackjack players who ignored her. Nately stared at her covertly from his overstuffed yellow armchair, marveling at the bored, phlegmatic strength with which she accepted the mass rejection. She yawned, and he was deeply moved. He had never witnessed such heroic poise before. The girl had climbed 5 steep flights of stairs to sell herself to the group of satiated enlisted men who had girls living there all around them. None wanted her at any price, not even after she had stripped without real enthusiasm to tempt them with a tall body that was firm and full and truly voluptuous. She seemed more fatigued than disappointed. Now she sat resting in vacuous indolence, watching the card game with dull curiosity, as she gathered her recalcitrant energies for the tedious chore of donning the rest of her clothing and going back to work. In a little while she stirred. A little later she rose with an unconscious sigh and stepped lethargically into her tight cotton panties and dark skirt, then buckled on her shoes and left. Nately slipped out behind her, and when Yossarian and Arfi entered the officer's apartment almost 2 hours later, there she was again stepping into her panties and skirt, and it was almost like the chaplain's recurring sensation of having been through a situation before, except for Nately, who was moping inconsolably with his hands in his pockets.
"She wants to go now,"
he said in a faint, strange voice.
"She doesn't want to stay."
"Why don't you just pay her some money to let you spend the rest of the day with her?" Yossarian advised.
"She gave me my money back," Nately admitted. "She's tired of me now and wants to go looking for someone else."
The girl paused when her shoes were on to glance in surly invitation at Yossarian and Arfi. Her breasts were pointy and large in the thin white sleeveless sweater she wore that squeezed each contour and flowed outward smoothly with the tops of her enticing hips. Yossarian returned her gaze and was strongly attracted. He shook his head.
"Good riddance to bad rubbish," was Arfi's unperturbed response.
"Don't say that about her,"
Nately protested with passion that was both a plea and a rebuke.
"I want her to stay with me."
"What's so special about her?"
Arfi sneered with mock surprise.
"She's only a whore."
"And don't call her a whore."
The girl shrugged impassively after a few more seconds and ambled toward the door. Nately bounded forward wretchedly to hold it open. He wandered back in a heartbroken daze, his sensitive face eloquent with grief.
"Don't worry about it,"
Yossarian counseled him as kindly as he could.
"You'll probably be able to find her again. We know where all the whores hang out."
"Please don't call her that," Nately begged, looking as though he might cry.
"I'm sorry,"
murmured Yossarian. Arfi thundered jovially. "There are hundreds of whores just as good crawling all over the streets. That one isn't even pretty." He chuckled mellifluously with resonant disdain and authority.
"Why, you rushed forward to open that door as though you were in love with her."
"I think I am in love with her,"
Nately confessed in a shamed, far-off voice. Arfi wrinkled his chubby, round, rosy forehead in comic disbelief.
"Ho-ho! Ho-ho!" he laughed,
patting the expansive forest green sides of his officer's tunic prosperously.
"That's rich! You in love with her? That's really rich!"
Arfi had a date that same afternoon with a Red Cross girl from Smith, whose father owned an important milk of magnesia plant.
"Now that's the kind of girl you ought to be associating with, and not with common sluts like that one. Why, she didn't even look clean." "I don't care," Nately shouted desperately, "and I wish you'd shut up. I don't even want to talk about it with you."
"Arfi, shut up,"
said Yossarian.
"Ho-ho-ho-ho," Arfi continued. "I can just imagine what your father and mother would say if they knew you were running around with filthy trollops like that one. Your father's a very distinguished man, you know."
"I'm not going to tell him," Nately declared with determination. "I'm not going to say a word about her to him or mother until after we're married."
"Married?"
Arfi's indulgent merriment swelled tremendously.
"Ho-ho-ho-ho-ho! Now you're really talking stupid. Well, you're not even old enough to know what true love is."
Arfi was an authority on the subject of true love because he had already fallen truly in love with Nately's father, and with the prospect of working for him after the war in some executive capacity as a reward for befriending Nately. Arfi was a lead navigator who had never been able to find himself since leaving college. He was a genial, magnanimous lead navigator who could always forgive the other men in the squadron for denouncing him furiously each time he got lost on a combat mission and led them over concentrations of anti-aircraft fire. He got lost on the streets of Rome that same afternoon and never did find the eligible Red Cross girl from Smith with the important milk of magnesia plant. He got lost on the mission to Ferrara the day Kraft was shot down and killed, and he got lost again on the weekly milk run to Parma, and tried to lead the planes out to sea over the city of Leghorn after Yossarian had dropped his bombs on the undefended inland target and settled back against his thick wall of armor plate with his eyes closed and a fragrant cigarette in his fingertips. Suddenly, there was flak, and all at once McWatt was shrieking over the intercom,
"Flak! Flak! Where the hell are we? What the hell's going on?"
Yossarian flipped his eyes open in alarm and saw the totally unexpected bulging black puffs of flak crashing down in toward them from high up, and Arfi's complacent, melon-round, tiny-eyed face gazing out at the approaching cannon bursts with affable bemusement. Yossarian was flabbergasted. His leg went abruptly to sleep. McWatt had started to climb and was yelping over the intercom for instructions. Yossarian sprang forward to see where they were, and remained in the same place. He was unable to move. Then he realized he was sopping wet. He looked down at his crotch with a sinking, sick sensation. A wild crimson blot was crawling upward rapidly along his shirt front, like an enormous sea monster rising to devour him. He was hit. Separate trickles of blood spilled to a puddle on the floor through one saturated trouser leg like countless unstoppable swarms of wriggling red worms. His heart stopped. A second solid jolt struck the plane. Yossarian shuddered with revulsion at the queer sight of his wound and screamed at Arfi for help.
"I lost my balls! Arfi, I lost my balls!"
Arfi didn't hear, and Yossarian bent forward and tugged at his arm.
"Arfi, help me!"
he pleaded, almost weeping.
"I'm hit! I'm hit!"
Arfi turned slowly with a bland, quizzical grin.
"What?" "I'm hit, Arfi! Help me!"
Arfi grinned again and shrugged amiably.
"I can't hear you," he said. "Can't you see me?"
Yostarian cried incredulously, and he pointed to the deepening pool of blood he felt splashing down all around him and spreading out underneath.
"I'm wounded! Help me, for God's sake! Arfi, help me! I still can't hear you!"
Arfi complained tolerantly, cupping his podgy hand behind the blanched corolla of his ear.
"What did you say?"
Yossarian answered in a collapsing voice, weary suddenly of shouting so much, of the whole frustrating, exasperating, ridiculous situation. He was dying, and no one took notice.
"Never mind." "What?"
Arfi shouted.
"I said, I lost my balls. Can't you hear me? I'm wounded in the groin." "I still can't hear you,"
Arfi chided.
"I said, never mind!"
Yossarian screamed with a trapped feeling of terror and began to shiver, feeling very cold suddenly and very weak. Arfi shook his head regretfully again and lowered his obscene, lactescent ear almost directly into Yossarian's face.
"You'll just have to speak up, my friend! You'll just have to speak up! Leave me alone, you bastard! You dumb, insensitive bastard! Leave me alone!"
Yossarian sobbed. He wanted to pummel Arfi, but lacked the strength to lift his arms. He decided to sleep instead, and keeled over sideways into a dead faint. He was wounded in the thigh, and when he recovered consciousness, he found McWatt on both knees taking care of him. He was relieved, even though he still saw Arfi's bloated cherub's face hanging down over McWatt's shoulder with placid interest. Yossarian smiled feebly at McWatt, feeling ill, and asked,
"Who's minding the store?"
McWatt gave no sign that he heard. With growing horror, Yossarian gathered in breath and repeated the words as loudly as he could. McWatt looked up.
"Christ, I'm glad you're alive,"
he exclaimed, heaving an enormous sigh. The good-humored, friendly crinkles about his eyes were white with tension and oily with grime, as he kept unrolling an interminable bandage around the bulky cotton compress Yossarian felt strapped burdensomely to the inside of one thigh.
"Natalie's at the controls. Poor kid almost started bawling when he heard you were hit. He still thinks you're dead. They knocked open an artery for you, but I think I've got it stopped. I gave you some morphine." "Give me some more." "Might be too soon. I'll give you some more when it starts to hurt." "It hurts now." "Oh, well, what the hell,"
said McWatt and injected another syringe of morphine into Yossarian's arm.
"When you tell Nately I'm all right,"
said Yossarian to McWatt, and lost consciousness again as everything went fuzzy behind a film of strawberry-stained gelatin, and a great baritone buzz swallowed him in sound. He came to in the ambulance, and smiled encouragement at Doc Danica's weevil-like glum and overshadowed countenance for the dizzy second or two he had before everything went rose-petal pink again, and then turned really black and unfathomably still. Yossarian woke up in the hospital and went to sleep. When he woke up in the hospital again, the smell of ether was gone, and Dunbar was lying in pajamas in the bed across the aisle, maintaining that he was not Dunbar, but a fortiori. Yossarian thought he was cracked. He curled his lips skeptically at Dunbar's bit of news and slept on it fitfully for a day or two, then woke up while the nurses were elsewhere and eased himself out of bed to see for himself. The floor swayed like the floating raft at the beach, and the stitches on the inside of his thigh bit into his flesh like fine sets of fish teeth as he limped across the aisle to peruse the name on the temperature card on the foot of Dunbar's bed. But sure enough, Dunbar was right. He was not Dunbar anymore, but Second Lieutenant Anthony F. Fortiori.
"What the hell's going on?"
A. Fortiori got out of bed and motioned to Yossarian to follow. Grasping for support at anything he could reach, Yossarian limped along after him out into the corridor and down the adjacent ward to a bed containing a harried young man with pimples and a receding chin. The harried young man rose on one elbow with alacrity as they approached. A fortiori jerked his thumb over his shoulder and said, "Screw!" The harried young man jumped out of bed and ran away. A fortiori climbed into the bed and became Dunbar again. "That was A fortiori," Dunbar explained. "They didn't have an empty bed in your ward, so I pulled my rank and chased him back here into mine. It's a pretty satisfying experience, pulling rank. You ought to try it sometime. You ought to try it right now, in fact, because you look like you're going to fall down." The Osarian felt like he was going to fall down. He turned to the lantern-jawed, leather-faced, middle-aged man lying in the bed next to Dunbar's, jerked his thumb over his shoulder, and said, "Screw." The middle-aged man stiffened fiercely and glared. "He's a major," Dunbar explained. "Why don't you aim a little lower and try becoming Warrant Officer Homer Lumley for a while? Then you can have a father in the state legislature and a sister who's engaged to a champion skier. Just tell him you're a captain." Yossarian turned to the startled patient Dunbar had indicated.
"I'm a captain,"
he said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder. "Screw." The startled patient jumped down to the floor at Yossarian's command and ran away. Yossarian climbed up into his bed and became Warrant Officer Homer Lumley, who felt like vomiting and was covered suddenly with a clammy sweat. He slept for an hour and wanted to be Yossarian again. It did not mean so much to have a father in the state legislature and a sister who was engaged to a champion skier. Dunbar led the way back to Yossarian's ward, where he thumbed A fortiori out of bed to become Dunbar again for a while. There was no sign of Warrant Officer Homer Lumley. Nurse Kramer was there, though, and sizzled with sanctimonious anger like a damp firecracker. She ordered Yossarian to get right back into his bed and blocked his path so he couldn't comply. Her pretty face was more repulsive than ever. Nurse Kramer was a good-hearted, sentimental creature who rejoiced unselfishly at news of weddings, engagements, births, and anniversaries, even though she was unacquainted with any of the people involved. "Are you crazy?" she scolded virtuously, shaking an indignant finger in front of his eyes. "I suppose you just don't care if you kill yourself, do you?"
"It's myself," he reminded her.
"I suppose you just don't care if you lose your leg, do you?"
"It's my leg."
"It certainly is not your leg," Nurse Kramer retorted. "That leg belongs to the U.S. government. It's no different than a gear or a bedpan. The Army has invested a lot of money to make you an airplane pilot, and you've no right to disobey the doctor's orders." Yossarian was not sure he liked being invested in. Nurse Kramer was still standing directly in front of him so that he could not pass. His head was aching. Nurse Kramer shouted at him some question he could not understand. He jerked his thumb over his shoulder and said,
"Screw."
Nurse Kramer cracked him in the face so hard she almost knocked him down. Yossarian drew back his fist to punch her in the jaw just as his leg buckled and he began to fall. Nurse Duckett strode up in time to catch him. She addressed them both firmly.
"Just what's going on here?"
"He won't get back into his bed," Nurse Kramer reported zealously in an injured tone. "Sue Ann, he said something absolutely horrible to me. Oh, I can't even make myself repeat it."
"She called me a gear," Yossarian muttered.
Nurse Duckett was not sympathetic.
"Will you get back into bed," she said, "or must I take you by your ear and put you there?"
"Take me by my ear and put me there,"
Yossarian dared her. Nurse Duckett took him by his ear and put him back in bed. 27. Nurse Duckett. Nurse Sue Ann Duckett was a tall, spare, mature, straight-backed woman with a prominent, well-rounded ass, small breasts, and angular, ascetic New England features that came equally close to being very lovely and very plain. Her skin was white and pink, her eyes small, her nose and chin slender and sharp. She was able, prompt, strict, and intelligent. She welcomed responsibility and kept her head in every crisis. She was adult and self-reliant, and there was nothing she needed from anyone. Yossarian took pity and decided to help her. Next morning, while she was standing bent over smoothing the sheets at the foot of his bed, he slipped his hand stealthily into the narrow space between her knees and all at once brought it up swiftly under her dress as far as it would go. Nurse Duckett shrieked and jumped into the air a mile, but it wasn't high enough, and she squirmed and vaulted and seesawed back and forth on her divine fulcrum for almost a full 15 seconds before she wiggled free finally and retreated frantically into the aisle with an ashen, trembling face. She backed away too far, and Dunbar, who had watched from the beginning, sprang forward on his bed without warning and flung both arms around her bosom from behind. Nurse Duckett let out another scream and twisted away, fleeing far enough from Dunbar for Yossarian to lunge forward and grab her by the snatch again. Nurse Duckett bounced out across the aisle once more, like a ping-pong ball with legs. Dunbar was waiting vigilantly, ready to pounce. She remembered him just in time and leaped aside. Dunbar missed completely and sailed by her, over the bed to the floor, landing on his skull with a soggy, crunching thud that knocked him cold. He woke up on the floor with a bleeding nose and exactly the same distressful head symptoms he had been feigning all along. The ward was in a chaotic uproar. Nurse Duckett was in tears, and Yossarian was consoling her apologetically as he sat beside her on the edge of a bed. The commanding colonel was wroth and shouting at Yossarian that he would not permit his patients to take indecent liberties with his nurses.
"What do you want from him?"
Dunbar asked plaintively from the floor, wincing at the vibrating pains in his temples that his voice set up.
"He didn't do anything."
"I'm talking about you!"
the thin, dignified colonel bellowed as loudly as he could.
"You're going to be punished for what you did!"
"What do you want from him?"
Yossarian called out.
"All he did was fall on his head."
"And I'm talking about you, too,"
the colonel declared, whirling to rage at Yossarian.
"You're going to be good and sorry you grabbed Nurse Duckett by the bosom."
"I didn't grab Nurse Duckett by the bosom," said Yossarian.
"I grabbed her by the bosom," said Dunbar.
"Are you both crazy?"
the doctor cried shrilly, backing away in paling confusion.
"Yes, he really is crazy, Doc,"
Dunbar assured him.
"Every night he dreams he's holding a live fish in his hands."
The doctor stopped in his tracks with a look of elegant amazement and distaste, and the ward grew still.
"He does what?"
he demanded.
He dreams he's holding a live fish in his hand."
"What kind of fish?"
the doctor inquired sternly of Yossarian.
I don't know," Yossarian answered. "I can't tell one kind of fish from another."
"In which hand do you hold them?"
"It varies," answered Yossarian.
"It varies with the fish,"
Dunbar added helpfully. The colonel turned and stared down at Dunbar suspiciously with a narrow squint.
"Yes? And how come you seem to know so much about it?"
"I'm in the dream,"
Dunbar answered without cracking a smile. The colonel's face flushed with embarrassment. He glared at them both with cold, unforgiving resentment.
"Get up off the floor and into your bed,"
he directed Dunbar through thin lips.
"And I want to hear another word about this dream from either one of you.
I got a man on my staff to listen to disgusting bilge like this."
"Just why do you think?"
carefully inquired Major Sanderson, the soft and thick-set smiling staff psychiatrist to whom the colonel had ordered Yossarian sent,
"that Colonel Farage finds your dream disgusting."
Yossarian replied respectfully,
"I suppose it's either some quality in the dream or some quality in Colonel Farage."
"That's very well put,"
applauded Major Sanderson, who wore squeaking GI shoes and had charcoal black hair that stood up almost straight.
"For some reason," he confided, "Colonel Farage has always reminded me of a seagull. He doesn't put much faith in psychiatry, you know."
"You don't like seagulls, do you?"
inquired Yossarian.
"Oh, not very much,"
admitted Major Sanderson with a sharp, nervous laugh, and pulled at his pendulous second chin lovingly as though it were a long goatee.
I think your dream is charming, and I hope it recurs frequently so that we can continue discussing it. Would you like a cigarette?
He smiled when Yossarian declined.
Just why do you think, he asked knowingly, that you have such a strong aversion to accepting a cigarette from me?
I put one out a second ago. It's still smoldering in your ashtray. Major Sanderson chuckled.
That's a very ingenious explanation. But I suppose we'll soon discover the true reason.
He tied a sloppy double bow in his open shoelace and then transferred a lined yellow pad from his desk to his lap.
This fish you dream about. Let's talk about that. It's always the same fish, isn't it?
I don't know, Yossarian replied. I have trouble recognizing fish.
What does the fish remind you of?
Other fish?
And what do the other fish remind you of?
Other fish? Major Sanderson sat back disappointedly.
Do you like fish?
Not especially.
Just why do you think you have such a morbid aversion to fish?
Asked Major Sanderson triumphantly. They're too bland, Yossarian answered, and too bony. Major Sanderson nodded understandingly with a smile that was agreeable and insincere.
That's a very interesting explanation, but we'll soon discover the true reason, I suppose. Do you like this particular fish, the one you're holding in your hand?
I have no feelings about it either way.
Do you dislike the fish? Do you have any hostile or aggressive emotions toward it?
No, not at all. In fact, I rather like the fish.
Then you do like the fish.
Oh, no. I have no feelings toward it either way.
But you just said you liked it. And now you say you have no feelings toward it either way. I've just caught you in a contradiction. Don't you see?
Yes, sir. I suppose you have caught me in a contradiction. Major Sanderson proudly lettered contradiction on his pad with his thick black pencil.
Just why do you think, he resumed when he had finished, looking up, that you made those two statements expressing contradictory emotional responses to the fish?
I suppose I have an ambivalent attitude toward it.
Major Sanderson sprang up with joy when he heard the words ambivalent attitude.
You do understand, he exclaimed, wringing his hands together ecstatically. Oh, you can't imagine how lonely it's been for me, talking day after day to patients who haven't the slightest knowledge of psychiatry, trying to cure people who have no real interest in me or my work. It's given me such a terrible feeling of inadequacy.
A shadow of anxiety crossed his face.
I can't seem to shake it.
Really?
Asked Yossarian, wondering what else to say.
Why do you blame yourself for gaps in the education of others?
It's silly, I know,
Major Sanderson replied uneasily with a giddy, involuntary laugh.
But I always depended very heavily on the good opinion of others. I reached puberty a bit later than all the other boys my age, you see, and it's given me a sort of, all sorts of problems. I just know I'm going to enjoy discussing them with you. I'm so eager to begin that I'm almost reluctant to digress now to your problem, but I'm afraid I must. Colonel Farage would be cross if he knew we were spending all our time on me. I'd like to show you some ink blots now to find out what certain shapes and colors remind you of.
You can save yourself the trouble, Doctor. Everything reminds me of sex.
Does it?
Cried Major Sanderson with delight, as though unable to believe his ears.
Now we're really getting somewhere. Do you ever have any good sex dreams?
My fish dream is a sex dream.
No, I mean real sex dreams. The kind where you grab some naked bitch by the neck and pinch her and punch her in the face until she's all bloody and then throw yourself down to ravish her and burst into tears because you love her and hate her so much you don't know what else to do. That's the kind of sex dreams I like to talk about. Don't you ever have sex dreams like that?
Yossarian reflected a moment with a wise look.
That's, fish dream, he decided.
Major Sanderson recoiled as though he had been slapped.
Yes, of course, he conceded frigidly, his manner changing to one of edgy and defensive antagonism. But I'd like you to dream one like that anyway, just to see how you react. That'll be all for today. In the meantime, I'd also like you to dream up the answers to some of those questions I asked you. These sessions are no more pleasant for me than they are for you, you know. I'll mention it to Dunbar,
Yossarian replied.
Dunbar?
He's the one who started it all. It's his dream.
Oh, Dunbar,
Major Sanderson sneered, his confidence returning.
I'll bet Dunbar is that evil fellow who really does all those nasty things you're always being blamed for, isn't he?
He's not so evil.
And yet you'll defend him to the very death, won't you?
Not that far.
Major Sanderson smiled tauntingly and wrote Dunbar on his pad.
Where are you limping?
He asked sharply as Yossarian moved to the door.
And what the devil is that bandage doing on your leg? Are you mad or something?
I was wounded in the leg. That's what I'm in the hospital for.
Oh, no, you're not, gloated Major Sanderson maliciously. You're in the hospital for a stone in your salivary gland. So you're not so smart after all, are you? You don't even know what you're in the hospital for.
I'm in the hospital for a wounded leg,
Yossarian insisted. Major Sanderson ignored his argument with a sarcastic laugh.
Well, give my regards to your friend Dunbar, and you will tell him to dream that dream for me, won't you?
But Dunbar had nausea and dizziness with his constant headache and was not inclined to cooperate with Major Sanderson. Hungry Joe had nightmares because he had finished 60 missions and was waiting again to go home, but he was unwilling to share any when he came to the hospital to visit.
"Hasn't anyone got any dreams for Major Sanderson?"
Yossarian asked.
"I hate to disappoint him. He feels so rejected already."
"I've been having a very peculiar dream ever since I learned you were wounded," confessed the chaplain. "I used to dream every night that my wife was dying or being murdered or that my children were choking to death on morsels of nutritious food. Now I dream that I'm out swimming in water over my head and that a shark is eating my left leg in exactly the same place where you have your bandage."
"That's a wonderful dream," Dunbar declared. "I bet Major Sanderson will love it."
"That's a horrible dream," Major Sanderson cried. "It's filled with pain and mutilation and death. I'm sure you had it just to spite me. You know, I'm not even sure you belong in the army with a disgusting dream like that."
Yossarian thought he spied a ray of hope.
"Perhaps you're right, sir," he suggested slyly. "Perhaps I ought to be grounded and returned to the States."
"Hasn't it ever occurred to you that in your promiscuous pursuit of women, you are merely trying to assuage your subconscious fears of sexual impotence?"
"Yes, sir, it has."
"Then why do you do it?"
To assuage my fears of sexual impotence."
"Why don't you get yourself a good hobby instead?"
Major Sanderson inquired with friendly interest.
"Like fishing. Do you really find Nurse Duckett so attractive? I should think she was rather bony. Rather bland and bony, you know? Like a fish."
"I hardly know Nurse Duckett."
"Then why did you grab her by the bosom? Merely because she has one?"
"Dunbar did that."
"Oh, don't start that again,"
Major Sanderson exclaimed with vitriolic scorn and hurled down his pencil disgustedly.
Do you really think that you can absolve yourself of guilt by pretending to be someone else? I don't like you, Fortiori. Do you know that? I don't like you at all.
Yossarian felt a cold, damp wind of apprehension blow over him.
I'm not Fortiori, sir, he said timidly. I'm Yossarian.
You who?
My name is Yossarian, sir, and I'm in the hospital with a wounded leg.
Your name is Fortiori,
Major Sanderson contradicted him belligerently.
And you're in the hospital for a stone in your salivary gland.
Oh, come on, Major, Yossarian exploded. I ought to know who I am.
And I've got an official army record here to prove it,
Major Sanderson retorted.
You'd better get a grip on yourself before it's too late. First you're Dunbar, now you're Yossarian. The next thing you know, you'll be claiming you're Washington Irving. Do you know what's wrong with you? You've got a split personality. That's what's wrong with you.
Perhaps you're right, sir,
Yossarian agreed diplomatically.
I know I'm right. You've got a bad persecution complex. You think people are trying to harm you.
People are trying to harm me.
You see, you have no respect for excessive authority or obsolete traditions. You're dangerous and depraved, and you ought to be taken outside and shot.
Are you serious?
You're an enemy of the people.
Are you nuts?
Yossarian shouted.
No, I'm not nuts.
Dobbs roared furiously back in the ward, in what he imagined was a furtive whisper.
Hungry Joe saw him, I tell you. He saw him yesterday when he flew to Naples to pick up some black market air conditioners for Colonel Cathcart's farm. They got a big replacement center there, and it's filled with hundreds of pilots, bombardiers, and gunners on the way home. They got 45 missions, that's all. A few with Purple Hearts have even less. Replacement crews are pouring in from the States into other bomber groups. They want everyone to serve overseas at least once, even administrative personnel. Don't you read the papers? We've got to kill him now.
You've only got two more missions to fly,
Yossarian reasoned with him in a low voice.
Why take a chance?
I can get killed flying them, too,
Dobbs answered pugnaciously in his rough, quavering voice.
We can kill him first thing tomorrow morning when he drives back from his farm. I've got the gun right here.
Yossarian goggled with amazement as Dobbs pulled a gun out of his pocket and displayed it high in the air.
Are you crazy? He hissed frantically. Put it away and keep your idiot voice down.
What are you worried about?
Dobbs asked with offended innocence.
No one can hear us.
Hey, knock it off down there,
a voice rang out from the far end of the ward.
Can't you see we're trying to nap?
What the hell are you, a wise guy?
Dobbs yelled back and spun with clenched fists, ready to fight. He whirled back to Yossarian and before he could speak, sneezed thunderously 6 times, staggering sideways on rubbery legs in the intervals and raising his elbow ineffectively to fend each seizure off. The lids of his watery eyes were puffy and inflamed.
Does he think?
He demanded, sniffing spasmodically and wiping his nose with the back of his sturdy wrist.
He is a cop or something?
He's a CID man,
Yossarian notified him tranquilly.
We got 3 here now, and more on the way. Oh, don't be scared. They're after a forger named Washington Irving. They're not interested in murderers.
Murderers?
Dobbs was affronted.
Why do you call us murderers? Just because we're going to murder Colonel Cathcart?
Be quiet, damn you,
directed Yossarian.
Can't you whisper?
I am whispering.
You're still shouting.
No, I'm not.
Hey, shut up down there, will you?
Patients all over the ward began hollering at Dobbs.
I'll fight you all,
Dobbs screamed back at them and stood up on a rickety wooden chair, waving the gun wildly. Yossarian caught his arm and yanked him down. Dobbs began sneezing again.
I have an allergy,
he apologized when he had finished, his nostrils running and his eyes streaming with tears.
That's too bad. You'd make a great leader of men without it.
Colonel Cathcart's the murderer,
Dobbs complained hoarsely when he had shoved away a soiled, crumpled khaki handkerchief.
Colonel Cathcart's the one who's going to murder us all if we don't do something to stop him.
Maybe he won't raise the missions anymore. Maybe 60 is as high as he'll go.
He always raises the missions. You know that better than I do.
Dobbs swallowed and bent his intense face very close to Yossarian's, the muscles in his bronze rock-like jaw bunching up into quivering knots.
Just say it's okay, and I'll do the whole thing tomorrow morning. Do you understand what I'm telling you? I'm whispering now, ain't I?
Yossarian tore his eyes away from the gaze of burning entreaty Dobbs had fastened on him.
Why the goddamn hell don't you just go out and do it? He protested. Why don't you stop talking to me about it and do it alone?
I'm afraid to do it alone. I'm afraid to do anything alone.
Then leave me out of it. I'd have to be crazy to get mixed up in something like this now. I got a million-dollar leg wound here. They're going to send me home.
Are you crazy?
Dobbs exclaimed in disbelief.
All you got there is a scratch. He'll have you back flying combat missions the day you come out, Purple Heart and all.
Then I really will kill him, Yossarian vowed. I'll come looking for you and we'll do it together.
Then let's do it tomorrow while we still got the chance,
Dobbs pleaded.
The chaplain says he's volunteered the group for Avignon again. I may be killed before you get out. Look how these hands of mine shake. I can't fly a plane. I'm not good enough.
Yossarian was afraid to say yes.
I want to wait and see what happens first.
The trouble with you is that you just won't do anything,
Dobbs complained in a thick, infuriated voice.
I'm doing everything I possibly can,
the chaplain explained softly to Yossarian after Dobbs had departed.
I even went to the medical tent to speak to Dr. Nika about helping you.
Yes, I can see.
Yossarian suppressed a smile.
What happened?
They painted my gums purple,
the chaplain replied sheepishly.
They painted his toes purple, too,
Nately added in outrage,
and then gave him a laxative. But I went back this morning to see him. And they painted his gums purple again,
said Nately.
But I did get to speak to him,
the chaplain argued in a plaintive tone of self-justification.
Dr. Danica seems like such an unhappy man. He suspects that someone is plotting to transfer him to the Pacific Ocean. All this time he's been thinking of coming to me for help. When I told him I needed his help, he wondered if there wasn't a chaplain I couldn't go see.
The chaplain waited in patient dejection when Yossarian and Dunbar both broke into laughter.
I used to think it was immoral to be unhappy,
he continued as though keening aloud in solitude.
Now I don't know what to think anymore. I'd like to make the subject of immorality the basis of my sermon this Sunday, but I'm not sure I ought to give any sermon at all with these purple gums. Colonel Korn was very displeased with them.
Chaplain, why don't you come into the hospital with us for a while and take it easy? Yossarian invited. You can be very comfortable here.
The brash iniquity of the proposal tempted and amused the chaplain for a second or two.
No, I don't think so,
he decided reluctantly.
I want to arrange for a trip to the mainland to see a mail clerk named Wintergreen. Dr. Danica told me he could help.
Wintergreen is probably the most influential man in the whole theater of operations. He's not only a mail clerk, but he has access to a mimeograph machine. He won't help anybody. That's one of the reasons he'll go far.
I'd like to speak to him anyway. There must be somebody who will help you.
Do it for Dunbar, Chaplain,
Yossarian corrected with a superior air.
I've got this million-dollar leg wound that will take me out of combat. If that doesn't do it, there's a psychiatrist who thinks I'm not good enough to be in the army.
I'm the one who isn't good enough to be in the army, Dunbar whined jealously. It was my dream.
It's not the dream, Dunbar, Yossarian explained. He likes your dream. It's my personality. He thinks it's split.
It's split right down the middle,
said Major Sanderson, who had laced his lumpy GI shoes for the occasion and had slicked his charcoal dull hair down with some stiffening and redolent tonic. He smiled ostentatiously to show himself reasonable and nice.
"I'm not saying that to be cruel and insulting," he continued with cruel and insulting delight. "I'm not saying it because I hate you and want revenge. I'm not saying it because you rejected me and hurt my feelings terribly. No, I'm a man of medicine, and I'm being coldly objective. I have very bad news for you. Are you man enough to take it?"
"God, no!" screamed Yossarian. "I'll go right to pieces!"
Major Sanderson flew instantly into a rage.
"Can you even do one thing right?" he pleaded, turning beet red with vexation and crashing the sides of both fists down upon his desk together. "The trouble with you is that you think you're too good for all the conventions of society. You probably think you're too good for me, too, just because I arrived at puberty late. Well, do you know what you are? You're a frustrated, unhappy, disillusioned, undisciplined, maladjusted young man."
Major Sanderson's disposition seemed to mellow as he reeled off the uncomplimentary adjectives.
"Yes, sir," Yossarian agreed carefully. "I guess you're right."
"Of course I'm right. You're immature. You've been unable to adjust to the idea of war."
"Yes, sir."
"You have a morbid aversion to dying. You probably resent the fact that you're at war and might get your head blown off any second."
"I'm more than resent it, sir. I'm absolutely incensed."
"You have deep-seated survival anxieties, and you don't like bigots, bullies, snobs, or hypocrites. Subconsciously, there are many people you hate."
"Consciously, sir, consciously,"
Yossarian corrected in an effort to help.
"I hate them consciously."
"You're antagonistic to the idea of being robbed, exploited, degraded, humiliated, or deceived. Misery depresses you. Ignorance depresses you. Persecution depresses you. Violence depresses you. Slums depress you. Greed depresses you. Crime depresses you. Corruption depresses you. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if you're a manic depressive."
"Yes, sir. Perhaps I am."
"Don't try to deny it."
"I'm not denying it, sir,"
said Yossarian, pleased with the miraculous rapport that finally existed between them.
"I agree with all you've said."
"Then you admit you're crazy, do you?"
"Crazy?" Yossarian was shocked. "What are you talking about? Why am I crazy? You're the one who's crazy."
Major Sanderson turned red with indignation again and crashed both fists down upon his thighs.
"Calling me crazy," he shouted in a sputtering rage, "is a typically sadistic and vindictive paranoid reaction. You really are crazy."
"Then why didn't you send me home?"
"And I'm going to send you home."
"They're going to send me home,"
Yossarian announced jubilantly as he hobbled back into the ward.
"Me too,"
A Fortiori rejoiced.
"They just came to my ward and told me."
"What about me?"
Dunbar demanded petulantly of the doctors.
"You," they replied with asperity, "you're going with Yossarian, right back into combat."
Back into combat, they both went. Yossarian was enraged when the ambulance returned him to the squadron, and he went limping for justice to Doc Danica, who glared at him glumly with misery and disdain.
"You,"
Doc Danica exclaimed mournfully with accusing disgust, the egg-shaped pouches under both eyes firm and censorious.
"All you ever do is think of yourself. Go take a look at the bomb line if you want to go see what's been happening since you went to the hospital."
Yossarian was startled.
Are we losing?"
"Losing?" Dr. Nika cried. "The whole military situation has been going to hell ever since we captured Paris. I knew it would happen.
He paused, his sulking ire turning to melancholy, and frowned irritably as though it were all Yossarian's fault.
American troops are pushing into German soil. The Russians have captured back all of Romania. Only yesterday, the Greeks in the Eighth Army captured Rimini. The Germans are on the defensive everywhere.
Dr. Nika paused again and fortified himself with a huge breath for a piercing ejaculation of grief.
There's no more Luftwaffe left, he wailed.
He seemed ready to burst into tears.
The whole Gothic line is in danger of collapsing.
So? Asked Yossarian. What's wrong?
What's wrong? Dr. Nika cried. If something doesn't happen soon, Germany may surrender, and then we'll all be sent to the Pacific.
Yossarian gawked at Dr. Nika in grotesque dismay.
Are you crazy? Do you know what you're saying?
Yeah, it's easy for you to laugh, Dr. Nika sneered. Who the hell is laughing? At least you've got a chance. You're in combat and might get killed, but what about me? I got nothing to hope for.
You're out of your goddamn head,
Yossarian shouted at him emphatically, seizing him by the shirt front.
Do you know that? Now keep your stupid mouth shut and listen to me.
Dr. Nika wrenched himself away.
Don't you dare talk to me like that. I'm a licensed physician.
Then keep your stupid licensed physician's mouth shut and listen to what they told me up at the hospital. I'm crazy. Do you know that?
So?
Really crazy.
So?
I'm nuts. Cuckoo. Don't you understand? I'm off my rocker. They sent someone else home in my place by mistake. They got a licensed psychiatrist up at the hospital who examined me, and that was his verdict. I'm really insane.
So?
So?
Yossarian was puzzled by Dr. Nika's inability to comprehend.
Don't you see what that means? Now you can take me off combat duty and send me home. They're not going to send a crazy man out to be killed, are they?
Who else will go?
Dobbs. McWatt went, and McWatt was not crazy. And so did Yossarian, still walking with a limp. And when Yossarian had gone two more times and then found himself menaced by the rumor of another mission to Bologna, he limped determinedly into Dobbs' tent early one warm afternoon and put a finger to his mouth and said,
"Shush!"
"What are you shushing him for?" asked Kid Sampson, peeling a tangerine with his front teeth as he perused the dog-eared pages of a comic book. "He isn't even saying anything."
"Screw!"
said Yossarian to Kid Sampson, jerking his thumb back over his shoulder toward the entrance of the tent. Kid Sampson cocked his blonde eyebrows discerningly and rose to cooperate. He whistled upward four times into his drooping yellow mustache and spurted away into the hills on the dented old green motorcycle he had purchased secondhand months before. Yossarian waited until the last faint bark of the motor had died away in the distance. Things inside the tent did not seem quite normal. The place was too neat. Dobbs was watching him curiously, smoking a fat cigar. Now that Yossarian had made up his mind to be brave, he was deathly afraid.
"All right," he said. "Let's kill Colonel Cathcart. We'll do it together."
Dobbs sprang forward off his cot with a look of wildest terror.
"Shush!" he roared. "Kill Colonel Cathcart? What are you talking about?"
"Be quiet, damn it," Yossarian snarled. "The whole island will hear."
"Have you still got that gun?"
"Are you crazy or something?" shouted Dobbs. "Why should I want to kill Colonel Cathcart?"
"Why?"
Yossarian stared at Dobbs with an incredulous scowl.
"Why? It was your idea, wasn't it? Didn't you come to the hospital and ask me to do it?"
Dobbs smiled slowly.
"But that was when I only had 58 missions," he explained, puffing on his cigar luxuriously. "I'm all packed now, and I'm waiting to go home. I've finished my 60 missions."
"So what?" Yossarian replied. "He's only going to raise them again."
"Maybe this time he won't."
He always raises them. What the hell's the matter with you, Dobbs? Ask Hungry Joe how many times he's packed his bags.
I've got to wait and see what happens,
Dobbs maintained stubbornly.
I'd have to be crazy to get mixed up in something like this now that I'm out of combat.
He flicked the ash from his cigar.
No, my advice to you, he remarked, is that you fly your 60 missions like the rest of us, and then see what happens.
Yossarian resisted the impulse to spit squarely in his eye.
I may not live through 60, he wheedled in a